And welcome back to Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers. Who else am I forgetting here? Oh, how about the composers? How about the film editors? How about the sound editors and mixers? How about the choreographers? And of course, the VFX gurus. And speaking of VFX, congratulations to the teams at Weta who picked up some awards this weekend. Awards heavy. It's been an awards heavy week as we're counting down to the Academy Awards in a few weeks. But yay for Weta. Very thrilled. They were actually going against themselves in multiple categories. So wonderful to see wins for them. But something else wonderful is today's Behind the Lens. It's a very, very fun show for you today as we take a look at two very different films, one in present day and another in the medieval era. And we'll be taking a look at these thanks to my exclusive interviews with writer-director Steve Barnett, talking Valiant One, and writer-director-editor Matthew Ninaber, talking A Night's War. Both films are terrific and made with patience and a great deal of thought, research, and attention to authenticity. And you can ruminate for a minute and try and figure out which one is present day and which one is medieval. But first, I have to give a shout out to my good friend and our friend here at BTL, Frank Meyer, on the release of his new single, his debut solo single, Baby Dynamite. It is out now. I love it. Music video is also out. Check it out. And it's from his upcoming solo album, Living Between the Lines. And that's dropping around on March 25th. I'm going to try and get Frank into the studio, in the Adrenaline Radio Studios. And instead of a pre-recorded show, we'll have a live one for you. So Frank can talk about Baby Dynamite, Living Between the Lines, and of course, all the touring he's been doing. He just finished a jet-setting tour back east, playing with Dick Manitoba. And this past weekend, on Saturday, he was down in San Pedro, playing as usual and as frontman for Streetwalkin' Cheetahs. He is on the go. I don't even know when he sleeps. Seriously. But I'm so excited about his new single. I hope all of you will be too and you'll check it out. And hopefully I can get Frank to find some time on a Monday and come on down to Whittier and be in studio with me. So I'm crossing my fingers. But for today's show, first up is my exclusive interview with Steve Barnett talking about Valiant One. Personally, I am always up for a period piece, especially when it's an action piece that is steeped in military. I love this film. I didn't know what to expect when I saw it. I was not disappointed at all. It is set in present day, directed by Steve and co-written by Steve and Eric Tipton. And it's often nail-biting, edge-of-your-seat action based on a true story. The film has a wonderful cast ensemble led by Chase Stokes, along with Lana Condor, Desmond Borges, Daniel June, Jonathan Witsit, Kellen Mulvey, and Ronald Thompson. Now, as I said, Valiant One is based on a true story, which was told to Steve by his high school friend, Todd Charbonne. This film and this script has only been in development for about 14 years now. Todd is also a former Navy SEAL. He served as a military consultant on this film to ensure authenticity in action, dialogue, things like holding weaponry, even the placement of patches on uniforms. The gist of the story is a what-if scenario. What if the leaders or special ops members of a military mission that lands them in enemy territory die and is left to the surviving lower-ranking team members and civilian specialists to figure out how to get out of enemy territory and survive, and maybe even complete the mission? With Valiant One, taking that what-if scenario, with Valiant One, the what-if takes a U.S. military team into Korea. Intending to land in South Korea, of course, the U.S. helicopter has to crash in North Korea. And we all know that tensions are always hot between North Korea and the U.S. Now the survivors must work together to protect a civilian tech specialist and find their way out of North Korea without the help of U.S. military support. Already, the whole premise of the film is intriguing. As Steve and I, you know, already a legendary producer of films, he's a veteran producer of films like Priceless, which, if you are on BehindTheLensOnline.net, if you have read my interviews, listened to my interviews, read my reviews over the years, he was a producer of Priceless, which Ben Smallbone, I just interviewed Ben a couple months ago about his new film, Homestead, and which also has a series, and you can find all of that on the Angel Studios website. But Steve was the producer, boots on the ground producer for Priceless, on Legendary, The Marine 2, a great action film, 300, and he was one of the executive producers on the Glenn Powell movie, Hitman. He makes his directorial debut with Valiant One. And I said to him, what took you so long? As we start talking about the film, Steve was highlighting some of the challenges and the complex logistics, such as helicopter shots and live fire rounds that occur within the film. Also was the terrain. This was shot in British Columbia, which was a stand-in for North and South Korea. And I'll tell you, it looks pretty darn good. As a substitute for the terrain and the foliage that we have seen on news footage from actual news footage from Korea. So a big key that makes Valiant One so compelling and so interesting is Steve's work with his cinematographer, Dan Stilling, who happened to be the cinematographer that Steve worked with on Priceless. The cinematography is standout. Dan and Steve make the rugged terrain a character unto itself, which then allows Dan to develop a visual grammar that employs a lot of handheld and Steadicam work that creates an immersive first-person POV, which roots us in the character's shoes while creating an authentic, on-the-ground military feel. This also allows Dan to hone in on emotional beats with camera dutching and some unique angles in the terrain. I really love the cinematography here for the emotional beats and how that speaks to us and informs the film. Also important to the immersive nature of the film is editor Andrew Levin's work, who Steve specifically chose because of his expertise and ability to create tension similar to that in horror films. And in many respects, if you're captured, if the North Koreans catch you, it could turn into a horror film. So there is that possible specter there. The end result, it's tight, it's suspenseful. Then, of course, the performances are first rate. But what really stood out to me, and I hope will be to you, is several of the actors, like Lana Condor, who plays Selby, one of the military, quote-unquote, grunt workers, and Desmond Borges, who is our civilian specialist. Desmond, you may have just seen him not too long ago in Hangdog. He is so cast against type here in Valiant One, it blew my mind to see him first play in Hang Dog a couple months ago and now play here in Valiant One. Absolutely amazing. But Steve and I dig into everything. The music composer Benjamin Backus's music. He also contributed music to Priceless and is the composer on Homestead now, which Steve is not involved in, but he still has a relationship with Angel Studios and Ben Smallbone. So everything comes full circle when you're dealing with independent films. You pull in the people that you know, the people you've worked with before, and there's always a great crossover. And it shows in the final product. It shows in the work. So, without me blathering anymore, and you know I like the word blather, but without me blathering anymore, I'm going to go off in my green glow of the Eagles winning the Super Bowl and let you take a listen to my exclusive interview with Steve Barnett as he discusses the minutia of making Valiant One. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I am very happy to be speaking with you this Friday morning.
Well, I'm happy too, so this is great.
I just finished interviewing a few weeks ago a former colleague of yours, Ben Smallwood. Smallbone.
And yes. Ben Smallbone, very talented guy. Were you interviewing him for Homestead?
Yes.
Yeah. Ben's a good friend, a very talented man, part of a really incredible family.
And, of course, you know, you produced Priceless with him, which I still think is an incredible film.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, that was a real passion project for all of us. It's true independent filmmaking. We made that movie for $1 million, and it turned out great. He did such a good job on it.
He really did, and I covered that whole film, and I had spoken with Ben about that one, and so it was nice to see him with Homestead and see his growth as a filmmaker.
Pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, Homestead's a big movie, so he did a good job with that.
He really did. And you...
He spun it off into a series. I don't know. I'm sure he spoke about that.
Yes.
So, you know, making movies is hard enough. To add another 4 episodes or something must have been really, really challenging for him. But he did a great job.
He really did. And as a producer, you understand those challenges. You understand the challenges in getting any film made. And now here, I don't know what you were thinking, but you took off that little producer's hat and you put on your director's hat. You knocked it out of the park directing Valiant One.
Thank you so much. You just said something that is totally true. I had a moment probably on day two where day two was with the helicopter, all the exterior helicopter shots. And I had a moment when the helicopter was flying in for the first time where I was like, what am I thinking? Like, why didn't I do like a horror film set in one house, you know, with just people and lights? But no, I had to go make a movie with, you know, a massive helicopter and live fire rounds and all kinds of fun stuff. So appreciate you asking that.
So now answer that question. What possessed you to make this your directorial feature debut, when you could have gone a more typical or normal route of a one location horror movie in particular, which it's also very forgiving as a film most times, and one location helps. You could have done a simple rom-com, but no, you pick this that kicks off with helicopter crashes, fires, you're on rugged terrain, your poor DP, Dan Stilling, incredible camera work is happening here, taking advantage of dutching, using angles, using the terrain. You did not do anything on the easy side with this one, Steve.
I agree with you, and had I thought about that beforehand, I probably would have had second thoughts. I got to be honest, though, it was an incredible experience across the board. I'm glad you brought up Dan Stilling, because Dan shot Priceless for me. I don't know if you know that, but he also did Priceless.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a key. Dan Stilling and my producer, Bernie Goldman, who I did Land of the Dead with back in, like, 2005, my first film, like, forever ago. Bernie and I have worked together on a lot of stuff over the years. In fact, we worked on this one for about 13 years, 14 years before it got made. But back to Dan. Dan and Bernie, those were the two keys for me in making the transition to becoming a director and doing this movie. I felt so much, I felt so secure with those two. Bernie and I did 300 together.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously he's an incredibly talented producer on big movies. And then Dan is just an insanely talented cinematographer. So I figured those two would help me get this done, and they did. The experience was just incredible because of those two guys and because of my cast. You know, my cast was so giving and so collaborative that, it's never easy making a movie, but I do feel like I had best case scenario from all sides.
Well, let me follow up here about talking about Dan. The lensing is fantastic on this. We really get the sensibility. I mean, we've got the terrain. You've got some of these under the floorboard shots in the Korean family home are just wonderful. The tunnel shootouts, just outstanding. So I'm curious about the discussions that you had with Dan to design the visual grammar for Valiant One. Because it is very specific, but it's also very diverse, and it's very immersive into the military mindset and approach as we're on this hero's journey of Brockman. And also, it's a lost in the woods. Moses crossing the desert for 40 days, coming across whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about how you and Dan developed the visual grammar for this.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the comfort and shorthand that we have as friends as well. So I can really call him anytime and talk to him about anything. He's that guy anyway. But to add to that, we've known each other for so long. We can be honest with each other too. I think that's a big key. But to go back to the very beginning, I've been doing this a while. I'm a big fan of movies, so I like to analyze them. And what I did was, I put together kind of a rip reel of visuals from other films that inspired me, just in terms of the camera work, specifically the camera work.
Yeah.
That movie, Children of Men,
mm-hmm.
as I think some of the most incredible camera work I've seen. Obviously, Saving Private Ryan was an inspiration. Inglourious Basterds, you mentioned Underground. Obviously, there's a connection there.
Yep.
So, you borrow from the greats, right?
And then I
said to Dan, I go, this is it, man. This is your playground. Run. Just run. Do come up with crazy, crazy ideas, and then let's put this together. So it was the freedom that he had, as well as sort of the pre-planning that I had for what I felt my vision was going to be visually.
Were you guys shooting handheld for much of this? Because I'm looking at the terrain, and some of those areas, it would have been very difficult to lay down dolly track or something.
We did use some Dana dolly,
mm-hmm.
but we did a lot of handheld, a lot of steady. I wanted, it was important. Well, let me go backwards. This movie started out 14 years ago as a POV film. This is like after, I think, maybe Paranormal Activity, all of those movies that were doing these sort of first-person POV style movies. I was like, what if we did a military thriller? Because all these soldiers are wearing GoPros
mm-hmm.
for themselves. So what if we did that kind of thing? So that was the way into the story. We obviously pivoted from that style for the film, but that's still the DNA of this movie was immersive. So handheld was critical for that. Steadicam was critical for that. And then we wanted to have some fun with the techno crane and the dollies and all the stuff. So it's a combination of all of those things that I hope really works.
I think it really does because, number one, it helps showcase the military authenticity of this story. It puts us in the mindset of the various individuals, your characters. And by especially going with the handheld and the Steadicam, you can really shift the power play, the power POVs. Such as, when Leibold is like words of encouragement to Brockman, or when Weaver is being just a pain in the butt. but suddenly has to step up his game. And we'll get that high-low Dutching in there. And yeah. It just works so beautifully. But at all times, we don't come out of their POV. And I think it's because of the visual grammar that you designed. You keep us there with them.
That was truly what you just picked up on was the number one rule for making this film was making sure that we're in the POV, never really leaving the POV of our characters. Films do that, and they do it incredibly well. But, you know, we don't cut back to headquarters. We don't ever leave these characters. I mean, obviously, we intercut in that moment with Liebold, Cal Mulvey, and Liebold as he stays back with the helicopter, and then we intercut between that and our soldiers. But that was done for a very specific reason, too. Mm-hmm. You remember in that scene, that was for tension. So POV is everything.
Yeah.
I think I'm glad you picked up on that because I was so annoying about that. You know, DPs like to shoot stuff. They don't care about POV as much because they want to get cool shots. So we had a bit of that as well along the way. So I think the combination of the two really worked for us.
Well, it really does. And then, of course, you hand this off to your editor, to Andrew Levin. I love the editing. The editing is crisp. You build tension every step of the way. When we get into the home of the North Korean family, that is so fraught with tension. And what's interesting is the counter that you have on that particular day of it's a bright, sunny day outside. So it's a great juxtaposition to the fear, to the tension of what's happening. I mean, there's a beautiful, beautiful candlelit nighttime scene in the house. And then the next day it's bright and sunny, sunlight's coming through. And you're really wondering, what's going to happen? Are they going to live? Are they going to get turned over? And you really build it and sell it. And a lot of that is due to Andrew's work. So I'm curious, and plus we get the whole pacing of the rapidity of how things happen when you're out on military maneuvers or in a dangerous military situation. Everything can turn on a dime, and we feel that. So I'm curious about your work with Andrew and being in the editing bay on this one.
Yeah, we got to hang out last night at the screening. He's incredible. He's just such a talented editor, so fast. Like I kept telling him last night, the dude is just lightning on the keyboard, which is, you know, which is insanely important when you're on a tight schedule. But here was the thought process behind. I had not worked with Andrew. I didn't know Andrew. He was recommended by a good friend of mine named James Tomlinson, and he had just worked with him on a horror film. And I wanted to create a horror-like tension on the first half of this film. When I developed it and when I designed the movie, when we were, you know, moving towards production and in the script as well, but more towards production, from a storytelling perspective as well as from a visual perspective, I wanted to have a movie that was pretty simple. It was run, hide, fight. And those were the three boxes that each act and each part of our movie kind of lived in. So the first two-thirds, it was really important that we created enough tension to keep the audience interested. And I felt the best way to do that is to go get somebody who was experienced, making horror films,
mm-hmm.
creating tension within an environment and within a group of people. So he did that. And I'm incredibly grateful to the work that he did on this film.
That is a fantastic philosophy to have for choosing your editor on this one, Steve. And it really worked very, very well for you. But I'm going to backpedal here to, I know that this whole thing was inspired by a true story, a high school friend of yours had told you and posited this whole brain, kicked your brain off into thinking of what ifs. What if? We're behind enemy lines. What if help isn't coming? What if your commander dies? So, and you built this, you and your co-writers, I mean, just built this up so well from a story standpoint. And then you cast this with some unexpected casting to really give us the flavor of the hierarchy within a military unit in terms of experience, in terms of street sense, military sense, and civilian, what the hell am I doing here? Just really fantastically done in that regard. And most notably, I gotta say it, as much as I love Chase Stokes as Brockman, the biggest surprise for me in your casting was Desmond Borges as Weaver. I had just finished months ago watching him in Hangdog. Never would I have thought of Desmond for this role.
Yeah.
As Weaver.
Yeah, I mean, Des is in, he's amazing. I mean, he's he's an incredible actor. So talented, but honestly, like, he's the best guy. He is just such a good human, and it was just such a pleasure to work with him and watch him work, truly. And, you know, watching the film again last night with Dez, Chase, and Lana in attendance, Dez hadn't seen the movie yet. He deliberately wanted to hold off till he could see it in the theater. I'm so glad that he did, because sound design, all the things, you know, as a filmmaker, you want people to experience it with. But I just was mesmerized by him last night. You know, when you're in the trenches editing these movies and you're dissecting it and putting it back together and you're playing with things, performance is always part of that equation, but it's one of many, many things. So last night I got to sit there and kind of, you know, for the last few months I've been focused on sound design and color and all the tech stuff, and you kind of don't pay attention to performance. So last night was a nice moment to sit there and really take in what our actors did, especially Dez and Lana and Chase. I mean, they're all so good.
Yeah.
But I got lucky. I said that to my producer. I said that to Bernie last night when I walked out of the theater. I was like, man, you know, we got lucky with this cast, and we got really lucky that we got Dez to play Weaver. Because, you know, Weaver is a guy who is, you know, I've always seen Weaver as he's obviously he's the non-soldier of the group, a defense contractor, probably incredibly well paid. He's the guy that, you know, would go to on a shopping spree to go on this mission. That's why he has obscenely annoying, obnoxious orange shoes. You know, he's put together to go on a military mission. So visually, I wanted to set him apart from these soldiers as much as possible, and then he just took the ball and ran with it when it came to his attitude and his tone towards these folks, and then his redemption in the end.
Yeah.
So he's a true artist.
And like Lana, this role is something new for her, stepping into Selby. You really have some people that are stretching what we know them for or might have seen them in. I think Daniel June as Wilson Lee is just wonderful. There's a great sincerity and sweetness that he brings. You've always got to have a guy in the unit that has that sensitivity, and I really think he brings that, especially when we get into the interaction with that North Korean family. Just on every level here, you've done such a great job, Steve. But through it all, you maintain the authenticity factor. So I'm very curious about how much research you did, not just on the page, but in order to properly prepare your visuals and work with the production design to ensure, and of course, the military authenticity of the individuals within the working unit itself. I'm curious about your research process into bringing this to life.
It all started with Todd Sharbett, a high school buddy of mine, who is the Navy SEAL who was in that helicopter when it lost control. They didn't crash, so that's why it says inspired by, but, you know, pretty much everything through the first act, everything up to the crash is all pretty accurate to what he experienced one day over the DMZ. Unfortunately, they got into that weather and they lost control of the helicopter again. They made it out. But he was also a producer on the film and our tech advisor. He was there every single day. I brought him in during prep early on so we could, you know, go on location scouts together, make some decisions based on what he had seen personally with his own eyes in South Korea along the DMZ. His involvement in the film was absolutely critical to the authenticity of this film. The way the patches, the way we dealt with patches on the uniforms, the direction of the flag, the details were all Todd. the way they carried the gun, the way they communicated with each other, the way they moved through the field, the way they moved through the tunnel at the end, was all because of Todd. So yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, because he's an incredible guy. I mean, he was a Master Chief in the Navy SEALs. He's truly one of the best among us, no question about it.
Well,
and the search was really all about finding a location that was consistent with North Korea, and then from there it just became details. The wood fire burning truck, the way the farmhouse looked. It's all visual references. Obviously, we couldn't go to North Korea, but we had a lot of visual references.
Visual references are great, and yes, your location is superb. And who knew that Canada could stand, British Columbia could stand in for North Korea?
Yeah, it worked pretty well.
Steve Jobs, so incredibly well done, an auspicious, wonderful directorial debut. I hope you're going to sit in the director's chair again, and don't wait to do it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much, Steve. You have a great rest of your weekend, and hopefully we will chat again in the future, sooner rather than later.
I hope so. You have a good day as well.
Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was director Steve Barnett talking about Valiant One. And you can catch Valiant One in theaters right now. Now, moving along, continuing with our theme of action for today, but set in the medieval era is A Knight's War, directed, edited, and co-written by Matthew Nineber. This is a true family affair in its making. One of the brothers is the production designer on it and built everything on this film. Everything is handmade. And a big portion of the film was also shot in Matthew's backyard, where they built a castle. I kid you not. So we're talking some creativity here. But in addition to Matthew, in addition to his brother Ralph, who is the production designer, his brother Jeremy co-wrote this script with him. And Jeremy also stars in the film as our knight in shining armor, Bodhi. And you guys know how much I love a good action piece, especially when it's steeped in lore, has some horror thrown in there, and lots of broadsword battles. So you get a lot of that in this one. To give you a brief synopsis of the film, Bodhi, he's a knight of questionable lineage, aren't they all? But he has a code. He has a moral code. And he embarks on a daunting quest to rescue the tainted soul of the Chosen One from the depths of a fallen realm. Negotiating a Faustian pact with the enigmatic gatekeeper of the infernal domain, Bodhi embarks on his own odyssey, confronting a gauntlet of trials, battling witches, demons, barbarians, and the unforgiving landscape of hell itself. Parts of this hell might resemble some of the parts of hell of a North Korea, too. Just saying. However, his resolve wavers as he discovers the true nature of the Chosen One's corruption, and her very return to the mortal realm threatens to unleash chaos and herald the resurgence of ancient gods. Faced with this moral dilemma, Bodhi must navigate the treacherous path between duty and the greater good, knowing that the fate of humanity hangs in the balance. Are you hooked yet? Now, you listen to this interview I have with Matthew, and if you're not hooked now, you will be. This is the fourth collaboration from Matthew and his brothers. and it works. And plus, you know, when you're dealing with low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget, family members might work cheaper or for free. So who knows, but it works in Matthew's films, and it definitely works here in A Knight's War, which, as I said, Jeremy stars as Bodhi. Kristen Castor is amazing as Avalon. Shane Nicely is the gatekeeper, and Matt himself is the evil invoker. And that is a great performance you have to see. Or you can even go to my website, because I already have something up on behindthelensonline.net and photo images and trailer. So you can really see the meticulous and beautiful nature of the cinematography, the costume design, headpieces. A lot of care and thought went into this. And Matt is also, as I mentioned, he's also editor of the film. Matt is nothing short of a joy to speak with. He is energetic, he's enthusiastic, he is passionate about filmmaking, and particularly in Night's War. This is a film that he and Jeremy dreamt of making since they were kids. They grew up loving medieval tales, old world lore, and stories about knights. Significant here, as I mentioned, is that the entire film, it's all handmade sets. And of course, the castle I mentioned, it's made of foam. You would never believe it. And it's still in Matt's backyard with the hope that there might be a sequel in the offing, which I really hope there is. You know, as we really settle into our conversation, much of it centers around the visuals and the atmosphere of the film. One of the wonderful cinematic aspects of medieval storytelling, such as A Night's War, is that there are horror elements incorporated into inspirational legends that then make for beautiful imagery when the story is being told in the hands of the right filmmaker. And Matt is definitely the right filmmaker for this story. He finds a perfect blend of swords and knights of old, with bloody fantastical legends, beautiful inky blue-black torchlit nights, which are beautifully captured by cinematographer Brent Tremaine. Just rich and lush and immersive. The inspiration for A Night's War, interestingly enough, comes from the origin stories of Lilith and other medieval lore, including that of demons and otherworldly beliefs. And with that as inspiration, Matt and Jeremy drew on that to develop this story. But it was key to them that they wanted this film, this story, and this setting to be transportive, immersing the audience in time and place, much as these old myths and dark fairy tales do. When you close your eyes and you imagine it as you're reading the text. The production design, the set decor, the cinematography, everything was meticulously planned, and the main focus was creating a detailed lived-in world. The visual grammar was developed through extensive camera testing. This wasn't a fly-by-night, oh, it's going to be dark, oh, we're going to throw in some fog. No, they went through extensive camera testing using real flames. There are fire scenes within the film. It is real fire. And vintage lenses. Key to this production really is the vintage lenses because of the way they capture the fire. And then, of course, the performances of Jeremy and Kristen are just amazing. They did their own stunt work. They trained for months before filming. They used real swords. They started their training with plastic, and then it got to a point where they started using real swords. But then once they did that, they had to alter the fight choreography because of the weight of the swords and also the weight of the armor and the restrictive movement that they then had. So this was by no means an easy production, especially on a low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget, where you don't have a Marvel movie budget at your disposal. It's just wonderful watching this and seeing it all come to life and then understanding the backstory of it all. And the icing on the cake here is really Sean Crowley's score, which complements the story and the characters. It never gets too heavy. It doesn't tromp all over emotional beats, just everything. It's really put together well. And you can see Matt's vision follows through on every level. There's nothing disjointed here. So we go detail in this conversation. So take a listen to my exclusive interview with Matthew Nineber talking A Night's War. Well, hello, Matt. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, and it's even finer because it's a Friday and I'm talking to you about a film that I thoroughly enjoyed.
Well, that's great. That's great.
We've had a shortage of these medieval kind of films for a while now. So, and it's always nice to see them because you can get very atmospheric and you can bring in a lot of the mythological lore that leans to the horror genre at the same time. And you do all of that beautifully here with A Night's War.
Well, thank you so much.
I was swept into the film with the visuals right away, I have to tell you. Between, I'm guessing it's your brother Ralph's production design, Robin Elliott's set decor, and Brent's cinematography, right away, I was swept into this and immersed in this world. It's everything you imagine medieval era to be. It's that you make great use with the fog, the smoke, the trees that are not lush and green, but they're sticky and black like an East Coast winter. Just right away. And then you give us these great characters. Your opening, Witch Burning, really sets the tone for the characters that we're about to see. And you just take it from there, and it is immersive. I just love it.
Oh, that's so good to hear.
Where did the idea for this film arise? I know you co-wrote this with your brother, Jeremy, who stars is our Shining Knight, Bodhi. And yes, he is a Shining Knight, despite all the dirt and the gray and everything else. Where did the idea for this arise?
So this idea came from, Jeremy and I have wanted to make a medieval movie forever, and we've been playing around with ideas since we were kids. We grew up on Conan, Barbarian, Willow, films like that. And originally, we were reading a book about the origins of Lilith, and we found out that Lilith might have been the first woman, not Eve, and that Lilith and Adam were a thing. Lilith left the garden, decided to hang out with some demons and have some offspring, and when she came back, saw Adam was with Eve, we're like, this is a crazy story. Like, this is absolutely crazy. So we started building this whole world of demons and Lilith off of that. And we actually wrote a whole, like, kind of Bible of this universe, of this world. And then this part of the story was our way in. It was the beginning for it. So there's a whole, like, kind of universe that we've kind of built with the Fallen and Lilith and it kind of all spawned from that story.
I have heard the story of Lilith before, so I love that reference here as part of the genesis, no pun intended, yeah. of A Night's War. And I can see how you have spun off from that idea as we get into the other realm. And the fantastical, everybody loves the fantastical about the medieval eras and the Knights of the Round Table and Merlin. This just goes to the darker side of that. You have this story crafted. You keep things tight. You've got a minimal cast because this truly is. It's a low budget, no budget, micro budget film that looks like you spent a heck of a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned, the big thing about this, it's the atmosphere. It's very atmospheric. We are immersed. So before the cameras even start rolling, you have to think about, be it storyboarding or talking with Ralph about production design and with Robin about set decoration. How did you go about designing the physical production design and look of the film that then you and Brent could come in on top of with light and lens?
Yeah, like I started finding images, like dark gothic images that kind of inspired us. We wanted to have like this renaissance, but so we wanted this elegance, but very dark and gothic mashed together. And so that was kind of our guiding light to the whole thing. All the sets were built, carved, and so it was easier. Like, the world that you're talking about did not exist. We had to create it, And so working with Darcy on costumes and working with Robin and constantly going back and forth. And we stole things from different movies, like the new Mad Max. We really like the War Boys with the white paint. I'm like, I want to do medieval War Boys. So let's take those guys, bring them over. And there's just all these Renaissance paintings that were Gothic inspired. We started grabbing those. I'm like, okay, let's just keep building the world and seeing where we can find things and keep layering it. And there's a lot of layers to this movie, whether it's the set deck, the armor or costumes or any of the villains. There's just, it took so much time just to get their aesthetics right, just dressing things and making the world feel really lived in. And we had to start pretty early on creating that before it was ready for camera.
So now once you get these great sets and you've got your costuming in place, and I have to say, I love Bodhi's armor. I love it. I love the fit. I love the movement that he still gets with it. And then the armament itself that you have. I'm a sucker for broadswords. Love them. They always look really good if your camera is angled right.
Yeah.
So you have all of this, and then you bring Brent in, who you've worked with before. You've worked with everybody on this film before, I think.
Yeah, the big thing is this movie was so scary to go into. I couldn't not work with, like, I had to know who my team was.
Yeah.
And before we kicked this off, I was like, guys, this is going to be a very hard shoot. If you don't like the story, if you're not in love with it, if you're not willing to, like, bleed, don't just skip this one. There's going to be an easier movie after this. This is going to be really hard. And so everyone was given a talk to scare them away before they joined. So, but yeah.
I love that. Of course, your brother Jeremy, who plays Bodhi and is your co-writer, if he screws up, he's a brother. You can slap him upside his head. No harm, no foul.
Exactly.
So Brent comes in. How did you and Brent go about designing the visual grammar? Because your visual grammar with the camera and the lighting is so specific, especially in differentiating the other realm. The world of the Invoker, which gets really very Caravaggio-like almost, with the pools of blood and the blood and the red glow and behind and the white horned mask. So how did you and Brent then go about designing the visual grammar in order to bring us those intimate, frightening moments, but at the same time expand it out for those barren fights out on a snow-covered land with wide shots that really give us an incredible idea of scope and grandeur, actually, and solitude?
Yeah, so we did a lot of camera tests before we went to camera, like playing around with lenses. We got these really old Zeiss glass that we're going to film on. And then a lot of it was just going out doing tests, just seeing what worked, what didn't work. We really embraced using real flames. So like having actual fire on set, the torches, and then the atmosphere. And we just started finding that as we started layering these things together, it's just like, oh man, this feels really, really good. And then for the exteriors, we had to pick a time of year that it was just dead. Everything had to be dead, which is the coldest time of the year. And we did some research on some movies that inspired us. And we found out that everyone's getting up at 4 a.m. You're filming maybe at 6 to like 10, and then you're done. And then you have to wait for the sun to go down and then pick it up again. So it was grueling getting the exteriors, especially out west, because we're getting up so early, walking in, 2 miles to get to locations, and then getting a couple shots. And then as soon as the sun comes up, we're like, oh, there's no sun in our world, so we can't film anymore. So
that's one of the beautiful things about this. So you were shooting night for night and day for day, correct? Because you have some night scenes there after Avalon is injured and Bodhi is taking care of her and the fire is going and she's propped up against and they're settled in for the night. That is such a stunning, visually stunning sequence, Matt.
That was a hard location to get to because it's on top of a mountain, and then you have to go down into a crevasse in the mountain. And we had ropes and rock climbers, and everyone's trying to help us get down there. And it was such a pain. pain to get that shot, but man, I love it. Like, the caverns are so massive, caverns. So
it is beautiful. For me, that is probably your money shots in the film.
Oh, great. Great to hear.
Really, really stunning. But I love the idea that you were also playing with real fire, especially with those old Zeiss lenses. I'm a huge fan of Zeiss lensing. They really do some pick up a certain glow and a certain fall off with fire. And that really plays so beautifully here.
I know a lot of people like using the LED fire effect, but the real thing is just so beautiful.
Yeah.
And if you can use it, it just makes a world of a difference.
So now, what camera were you guys shooting with? Because you are in a relatively low-light situation. You're in hard-to-reach locations. You need to try and be somewhat nimble and can't bring huge lighting packages with you. So what camera were you shooting with?
So we played around with what camera. We actually didn't go for a low-light camera. We went for a camera that had a global shutter so that the fight scenes looked better.
Mm-hmm.
And so we picked up the Komodo Komodo Dragon, and it's a small little camera. It's very light, not the best in low light, but it has a very nice image, especially for fight scenes and for movement that just feels organic and not as digital. So
yeah, that red Komodo works really well for action sequences. And this now I understand why your fight sequences look so good. Because of the camera that you chose. And those are some really nicely choreographed fight scenes.
Thank you.
Were Jeremy and Kristen doing their own stunt work there, their own fight choreography?
They did. So they started very early. I think 6 months before we started filming, they were doing the fight choreography. Jeremy was the fight choreographer and just making sure, again, they would start with plastic swords. And then they both decided that they wanted to use real swords. All right, but they were very, they put a lot of work into getting those fight scenes done, and a lot of problems they ran into, because originally they did the fight scenes without the armor, and then when they put the armor on, all of a sudden they were actually way slower, more limited on what they could do, and they had to redo a lot of the choreography on the fly just to make it work for the armor.
Wow, and I could tell they were using real swords because of the movement as they're lifting and they're trying to swing, especially with Kristen's armory wasn't as thick and as heavy as what Jeremy was wearing. But you could tell when they pick up a sword, that really is exertion that we're seeing on their faces.
Both of them are such champs, because it's one thing to pick up a sword for like an hour or 5 minutes, whatever. But if you're swinging a sword all day long for a 10-hour day, it is such a workout. And both of them were so sore, but they just kept on going and would do it again the next day. And that was something that I was worried about going into this. Like a lot of movies, they just use foam for the armor, they use foam for their swords. And you see it. You see it. It shows up on the movie. I think it ruins a lot of films that I've watched recently. And so I was very happy that they both decided to go, you know, be authentic. And I think it really shows up.
Now, I have to compliment you on what hair, makeup, and costuming did with the witches. Those face masks and the makeup are breathtaking. The golden one, it is to die for. Did you have input into the design of those masks and the makeup?
The masks we got from a sculptor who just does amazing stuff. And so we sent them kind of like what we're looking for, and they made the masks for us. And then Darcy just went to town on our costume designer of just like building a world where the masks kind of like, they're not witches, they're more like priests, they're more royalty, god-esque, like fallen gods. And I think she did such a great job of just bringing just such a, I don't know, a beauty to them. And they did such a great job.
And of course, the color contrast in the designs, so that we always can delineate who is who. Potentially the seductress, the giver of light, shall we say. She definitely stands out from the other two, but even the contrast between the other two, you get the sense of theater masks of drama and comedy because of the difference. And I just thought, so striking, so beautiful. But then we have this other role here, this guy, the Invoker, and you played him.
Yeah. So, backstory is I played a monster called Psycho Gorman.
Oh, yes, you did.
And they have my molds. And so anytime I need a monster, they're like, yeah, we'll make you a monster, but you have to wear it because the molds are based off of you. So it's how we get the creatures in our film.
Well, I have to say, number one, Psycho Gorman, I loved. I truly got a blast out of that, and I thought your performance as Psycho Gorman was absolutely wonderful. So I was tickled when I saw that you were playing a role in, that you were the Invoker here. That really made me happy. And
good.
That headpiece, that mask that you're wearing, that's chilling. And here again, it's another contrast and compliment to the world that you've created.
Yeah, that was the first character that we designed and kind of grounded the whole universe off of. And kind of like out from there, we built the other characters.
You did pay a lot of attention to detail, I have to tell you, because right down to the dirt in the fingernails, because you and Brent stay away from a lot of extreme close-ups, very few ECUs, but there are some. And when we see them, it's like a hand reaching for the sword, trying to grab it before death strikes again. And the dirt in the cuticles, in the fingernails, a lot of people overlook that. You did not. You did not spare dirt and mud.
Yeah. We didn't. No, like you said, a movie like this is about layers, about details, and it's about those little things that if you don't put love into it, then it really shows up on screen. So we had a great team that was just constantly flying in there, like, no, this has to be this way. And I think really everybody was so passionate about the movie, and that's really what makes something special is when everybody is invested on your team.
Now, I have to ask you, there's another element that comes into play here, and you could have gone in so many directions with it. That is your score, Sean Croley's score. What were you looking for musically to complement the dialogue, the story, and the action? This was not an easy mix to have to design music for.
I think Sean probably fired me probably 5 times because I just kept on coming back. I don't know how to verbalize it. Again, it's hard to communicate music when you're not a musician, but so there's a lot of like, I need a da-da-da-da-da, and then whoa, and like, so there's a lot of sound effects that I'm doing in his studio. And he's just so good. He's so gracious. And he is, what's so great about him is he goes through, and he doesn't just write music, but he goes to each character. He wants their backstory. And he starts creating a library of music for every character based on their emotions. And if you start listening to it, you'll actually see as two characters come together, their music starts intertwining with each other. And it really is something beautiful that he does that I haven't seen other people do. And I'm very in awe of the work that Sean does. So,
yeah, he did a beautiful job with designing the musical motifs for Bodhi and Avalon in particular. And as you said, as we get into the second half of that third act, you really start to notice the blend of the instrumentation and the musicality.
Yep.
So that they are becoming, it feels like they're becoming one.
Yeah, it's really fun just to listen, like rewatch the movie, just listening to the music and the story the music tells.
So now at the end of the day, this is going to come out on what, February 7th or so?
Yep.
This was a really challenging undertaking for you, Matt. And you succeeded beautifully. But I'm curious, for you as a filmmaker, what did you learn about yourself as a director, as a writer, and as an editor in making A Night's War that you can take forward now into future productions?
One, it's amazing what you can do with foam. So we built all the castles out of just foam, which is just amazing what you can do with the right people. But I think this was a dream to make this movie, and it's been a dream for so long, and it's something that we've avoided. Like, my brother and I, we avoided this movie because we were intimidated by it, And finally, we would just decide, hey, let's do it. And I think so much of going after your dream and doing something that is important to you, just you have to jump in, and then you have to figure it out once you get in there. And we really didn't know what or how to do it, but we knew we wanted to. And I'm excited that it came together so well. So, because I don't know if we necessarily had a plan. We just had a lot of, like, let's do this.
And is it true you shot part of this in your backyard?
Yeah, I still have a castle in my backyard. My neighbors think I'm crazy. And it's still there. My wife's just like, it needs to come down. I'm like,
No.
There might be a sequel.
Now, I was just going to say that. Am I going to get a sequel? Because I would love to see the further adventures of Bodhi and Avalon.
Yeah, we have two movies written. We're ready to rock and roll. We just got to get people pumped about this one. Hopefully this one finds its audience. I know the audience that will appreciate it out there, just, you know, connecting with them. And then obviously it just comes down to the money. It's like, can we get enough people to fund the next one? Because we love this story. There's a whole world that we're kind of building out, and hopefully has a place.
Yeah, this is a world that I want to see more of, and these are characters that I want to see more of. Because there are so many realms that they can find corruption in and be transported to.
Yes, yes.
Matt, job so well done. I've watched it twice already. I will be watching it again because I just like looking at so much of this film. I'll be honest. It's so beautiful to look at.
It is beautiful. It's very beautiful. Brent did a great job. Like I said, it's like paintings from a medieval world. And I'm so proud of what he did. So.
Yeah, that's like I said, it's like in some of those scenes with the Invoker, the interiors with the glow and the blood, it's like a Caravaggio painting. Oh, I can't wait to see what you bring us next.
Thank you.
Now, do you have another film coming out soon?
Yeah, we're working, we're taking a break from the medieval world to recover, and we're doing a murder mystery, and so super pumped about that one.
Now, have you started shooting that one yet?
We are almost wrapped. So.
Okay. I will be on the lookout for that one. I love what you do in front of the camera and behind the camera. So.
Well, thank you so much.
You've got me for life here, Matt. So.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And thank you so much for taking time today to speak with me. And I hope I hope we chat again in the future.
On the next one.
I'll be there. And that was Matthew Nineber talking about A Night's War. And A Night's War is currently limited in select theaters, but it's available tomorrow digitally, tomorrow, February 11th. So, no reason not to see this one. And that is all the time we have today. I think we've gone over. I'm not sure, but you know me. We keep going till we're done. But check out A Night's War, check out Valiant One. Both are worth more than a look. Now, a little teaser for you. Stay tuned for coming up within the next 2 weeks. It will be my exclusive interview with Julius Ona, the director of Captain America, A Brave New World, which hits theaters on Valentine's Day. So you'll hear the interview after the film is out. So there's no chance of spoiling anything for you. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.